is Dan Barish, the Jewish liberal from Cleveland.
And this is Matt Shepard, the Mormon conservative from Seattle.
And we are the Common Ground. So, today we are talking about the union issue, or as conservatives like to call it, right to work, or as Democrats and liberals call it, union-busting legislation.
So, you know, my position is pretty simple. I mean, it's you should have the right to choose whether you want to be in a union or not. And if the union, you see it as a benefit, then you can join. If you don't see it as a benefit, you don't have to.
The problem with this is one thing. Unions have their power because of their numbers. More members paying more union dues means more ability to pay for, yes, lobbyists and lawyers and everything else necessary to influence the agenda so that we have more rights and bigger clout in the workplace. And because knowing that if you aren't in a union, it's just you versus the company or you versus the employer, it can be very important to have mandatory membership be a thing. And So I actually don't enjoy the fact that I'm compelled to be in a union, and that in fact, if I were to somehow quit my union, I'd be automatically fired from my workplace. I don't enjoy that, to be very honest. You know, I am a member of a union. But, on the other hand, I see the union as very important. Because if you don't have the union, then you have no protection.
For me, it depends on what is going on. I mean, if you're in a workforce where you're being mistreated consistently and there are other issues and things like that, such as the way things were at the turn of the century in a lot of places, or where there used to be a lot of sweatshops.
And there are right now. There are right now. There's tremendous amount of workplace injustice. I mean, working a minimum wage job in this country is very hard right now.
Yes, but I've worked minimum wage jobs and was not mistreated. There were no real issues with that. In fact, there are some things that, I would have gladly, I graduated high school at 17. And at that point, I'm 17, so, I couldn't even get a job at Walmart because they're like, well, we want someone who's 18. I'm like, I'm graduated high school. I'm almost 18. I'll be 18 in, three, 4 months. Like, the only job, I went to temp agencies. I went to fast food restaurants. I went all over the place and no one would even look at me until I finally found one temp agency that would take me. And then, I found a very, very part-time gig working in a little warehouse where I would help unload rail cars. I would help to scan the things in. But I mean, this has other ramifications and the way that laws are and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, so to me, if you have the ability to do a job, you should be paid what you're worth, what your marginal. The economic term is failing me. Basically, you produce a certain amount, and you can't get paid more than your marginal worth, basically, what the amount that you make, or the company will lose money, and it doesn't make sense to keep you. And so a lot of the, the pushes for higher minimum wages and that sort of thing will lead to what is already happening in France and in a number of places here in the United States, the automation of a lot of people's jobs. So people will get kiosks instead of a person that takes your order at McDonald's or at any other fast food restaurant, or automatic burger cookers, which are becoming a thing. There's a number of things that will replace your job with technology. It's already happened at banks a lot with ATMs and things of that nature. And so kind of gone off and started talking about minimum wage, haven't I?
Yes, yes. And I do favor a higher minimum wage. But at the same time, I'm curious to watch these experiments we're carrying on in, for example, Seattle, which is phasing it in slowly and with some compromises. I am curious to see how that affects the economy. There's a lot of little social policy experiments that are taking place, whether it's minimum wage laws getting, the minimum wage getting raised in some places, or not having anything to do with the right to work. But, for example, marijuana legislation that's legalizing marijuana, even recreationally. I never thought I'd see that happen years ago. So there's just some experiments happening, and we'll have to wait and see what their effects are. But, you know...
Yeah, that's now, what, 4 states?
Not very many. So let's look at some macro stuff here. The concern among liberals and the... Okay, here's what I should say about right to work. Where it scares the pants off of Democrats and where we think it makes Republicans happy is that, granted, ever since FDR and perhaps before, the unions have been a big part of the Democratic coalition. Unions have donated a lot of money to Democratic campaigns. Union workers have knocked on many, many, many hundreds of millions of doors for the Democratic Party. That's huge. And so we know that the Republicans know that if they can break the legs of the unions, the Democratic funding operation as well as the Democratic Get Out the Vote ground campaign is going to be very weakened. So there's the same motivation to break the unions as there is motivation to, for example, make it harder for minorities to vote.
Most of the time that I've seen, it's not out of an animus that... making it harder for minorities to vote. There may be some instances where there is some animus against that to make it more difficult to vote. In our sabbatical podcast, I've got some stuff on voting that I'm going to bring up. But, I think it's the right to work, I think, has to do with, it takes away, what is it, often 3%? I think it's typically 3% of your income. Goes to the union.
Well, let's see.
Depending on the union, and it's automatically removed from your paycheck.
Yes. I mean, I do get a pre-tax union dues paid. It costs me $370 a year.
Okay. So, there are some instances where I definitely think that there is some overreach in that, such as some people being forced to join the union legally when they stay at home and take care of their sick parent. That has happened a number of times because they're officially considered medical workers because they take care of their ailing parent or a sick child, and so they do receive some small amount of government benefits to help take care of that child. Usually this is a very small stipend thing to help them take care of them. And so then the union comes knocking and says, hey, you are a worker you are a health worker, so you must join the health workers union.
I hadn't heard of that, but it's not surprising.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that sort of thing, where you're not getting any benefits of the union. They're not going to go to your employer and negotiate things. You're not receiving any benefits of the union. I definitely am against you being forced to pay dues and to be a member of the union.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And, it's not all black and white. Are there unions that are just, gross abuses of power? Absolutely. I'm being circumspect and talking about my own dealings with my union, but I don't really deal with my union at all. Where I work, the union becomes prominent really if you get disciplined. The thing is, though, that I've never been disciplined. And so, but therefore, I paid the union dues, and I don't really have much to do with the union. And my health benefits look no different from non-bargaining employees of the county. And so, there's not much difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, and then there's the interesting things such as the Boeing plant that they're opening up in South Carolina. The unions had a heyday because of that, trying to force them to open it up in a non-right-to-work state.
Right.
So, that was a big fight, and I believe that they were able to open it up in South Carolina, because I believe they're now making the Dreamliners there, which is interesting. It's an entirely almost entirely carbon fiber plane, but...
Yeah, pretty exciting. Crazy. I mean... I think that from the far left end of the party, the socialist end of the liberal spectrum in America, there is definitely this feeling that the rich and, big corporations are this cornucopia of wealth that we're just entitled to tap and punish and destroy. And as a more pragmatic liberal, this is bothersome to me because these individuals and especially these companies are actually the foundation of our wealth.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, are there corporate abuses? Yes. But to me, a lot of the benefits of being in a union, you know, it may depend on your industry and that sort of thing. But
right.
The benefits of being in a union often are outweighed by the detriments and the fact that you're paying a significant portion of your income to them when you may disagree with them or their tactics.
I mean, my personal relationship with my union, there's just not a lot of controversy for it for me because
mm-hmm.
I'm happy in my job. I certainly don't have an adversarial relationship with my supervisor. It's not a hostile workplace. I have never found myself running to the union for protection or running to them for anything at all. And so that therefore, you're not going to find a huge amount of passion in me about this.
Mm-hmm.
But I do fear that, you know, I know you might not have this agenda, but we as liberals do think that the Republican Party has this agenda of we have to break the unions so that we can break the Democratic Party. This is, you know, the skullduggery of politics. And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, that certainly goes both ways. That's why the Democrats want campaign finance reform, because they want to stop the big donors from donating to the Republican Party, let's be honest.
And, you know, they're not against Democrat big donors, they're against Republican big donors.
The Republican big donors
When you have ads that are financed by a billionaire against a billionaire on the other side, you know, that's kind of where, you know, where they're like, oh, too much money in politics, but it's being paid for by a Democrat billionaire.
Right. Basically, we don't have our own Koch brothers.
Bill Gates and the Starbucks CEO, and you know, there's... You do. There are
counter-narrative. Shut up.
There's
shut
George,
up. La, la, la,
George
la,
Soros.
La, la.
There's a lot of money on both sides.
So, you see what I just... It feels to us like we're being oppressed by the Koch brothers.
Because Harry Reid says that on the Senate floor every single day. Doesn't make it true. You know, the Koch brothers, as far as total political donations, they're towards the bottom of the top 10. But they're the first, consistently, they're a little more libertarian than they are conservative, but because there are certain Democrats and other thing democratic issues that they actually do fund. You know, the thing where they say, you know, the Koch brothers gave $490 million on, you know, on attack ads was one thing that Harry Reid listed the other. It was last year, I think he said that in one of his rants. But the way that he got that information was there were 21 organizations that the Koch brothers have donated to, and they made it look as if all of that donation money those 21 organizations, all of their money that they spent, it wasn't even spent, it was money that they had taken in, was going towards attack ads and all came from the Koch brothers, when just one of those 21 organizations has 90,000 individual owners or donors. So, I mean, like, a lot of this is skewing and or just outright lies all about the Koch brothers. You know, do they donate a lot of money? Yes. And personally, I would like to just open it up, because the whole, like, super PAC thing has made it much more difficult for people to hide, like, you know, where they're going and how they're spending their money, and has made, you know, people able to be a 501(c)(3), you know, it's muddied the waters a lot. So personally, I think we should just open it up and let the candidates take the money and use it for their own campaign, but then be transparent about it.
That would be a good compromise. The fear of us liberals is we don't feel that we have a huge asset in all these billionaires. We feel, whether rightly or wrongly, that the plutocrats are on the Republican side, and that's why we want to get money out of politics, or the big money out of politics, rather, because we feel that as long as there's big money in politics, liberals don't have a fair shot. Whether that's right or wrong, that's the visceral feeling of the liberal base. That's what I'm sort of putting out here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not correct. There are just as many, if not more, billionaires that donate in large amounts to Democrat campaigns and Democrat ideas. But the right doesn't really go out and attack them, so you don't hear about it very often. And so it changes the perception. Because generally, the right doesn't care about a bunch of the money in politics. If Bill Gates wants to spend his entire fortune donating to Democrat parties, I don't care. Which he does spend a lot of money on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. There's a number of things on that side, and then there's the political unions are a big thing, and so that's money that's taken from teachers and from things of that nature, which is interesting, which is why there's a ton of issues in Wisconsin with the teachers unions, where if there's any threat to the teachers union's power, they will declare, say, hey, no one's going to work, and everybody go down to the Capitol building and start protesting.
Well,
and so the state is still paying for their salaries, and then they get to go and protest.
What the governor did there was to strip the union's right to collectively bargain for wages, which does mean breaking the union. Wages for those workers have now plummeted, and it really is hurting them. And it's funny, conservatives, and well, not just conservatives, but a lot of people complain about crappy government workers. Well, here's the funny thing about us government workers. If you underpay us, you're not going to get good government workers. The same argument that is made in corporate America of you need to pay higher wages for a more quality worker applies in the public sector as well.
Uh-huh. And I agree, which in general is, there's a couple things I have here. One, more of this stuff needs to become private sector, so there's more competition. So I think in a lot of ways, FedEx and UPS do a much better job than the Postal Service, for example. In large part, because they don't have to deal with, one, the giant federal bureaucracy, and two, people politicizing and taking, there's a lot of, changing laws and that sort of thing, which makes it more difficult for them to run efficiently. And they don't have to worry about, one, like, competition. They don't have to improve on those matters.
Well, so, the Postal Service is losing a ton of money, and the reason it's losing a ton of money is Congress passed legislation forcing them to be the only branch of the federal government that is single-handedly responsible for covering employee pensions.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of things. So you, as a company, you wouldn't have to deal with those. Well, companies would have to cover all their employee pensions if they had them. So in that case, it wouldn't be much different. But there are things such as legislation which makes them responsible for things and that sort of thing, which changes their all that.
Right, but if the Postal Service got abolished or if it became privatized, wouldn't it face also the same legislative burdens? Wouldn't it also be responsible for all the same security concerns, et cetera, et cetera?
Not necessarily. And, it's also, it comes from a different perspective. So, here's an example of there is a guy I was listening to. He ran a contractor for the Army, or it was for the U.S. military. He ran a contract company for them. And so there was a supply drop-off, which had been being run by the U.S., by the Army. Was he the Army or one of the branches, by the military. It was being run by the government-run branch. And they were using 20 or 30 guys to do it, a number of helicopters, and that sort of thing. And the contractors came in, and they used three guys and got it done faster. So a fraction of the cost to run it. And, in large part because the contractors, usually the person who's designing it, also is the person who has to deal with the budget constraints. Whereas in a government installation, you have the people, they're going to get paid anyway, and you have to figure out what to do with them. And so it's a whole efficiency issue. You know, so I think that's a big part of the perspective change when you go from the public to the private sector. And so that's one of the things why, you know, in New Zealand, they completely privatized their postal service a number of years ago, and it's been running really well. And so I would be for much more of that, taking a lot of the government bureaucracy. In Europe, for example, the FDA, their version of the FDA is run by several private organizations. And they're running a lot more efficiently, running a much better FDA, basically, where there's, you know, it's a lot more of a cost-benefit analysis of the drugs and the other things that they put out there, as opposed to the cost-benefit analysis being political and or, you know, being not necessarily related to the actual work. So, I mean, it's gotten so ridiculous that if you put figure out an app that can use the existing stuff on your smartphone to test like the oxygen in your blood or something like that, that uses like the camera, you stick your finger up against the camera and it can measure blood sugar or something of that nature. The FDA has to approve that app.
Right.
One, and they also, every time you do an update to the app, they have to reapprove it. And so that's, you have to go through months or years of federal bureaucracy just to do an update on an app that has no effect on the function of the app.
Right.
Say you want to add Spanish to it or something, you know, that has to go through the FDA.
Wow.
And so there's it's considered a medical device.
And of course,
it has to be approved.
And come to think of it, of course, that'll have interesting complications for the Apple Watch, which can, among other things, detect your heart rate. I think it's a medical device. And so that means that every time a new Apple Watch comes out, they'll have to somehow get that fast-tracked, because they're going to probably bring out a new one every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, that's the kind of regulation burden that's being brought on by the government having different priorities than running themselves well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the government's, you know, the government has a different priority, and there are some times when that is a good thing. In many cases, it isn't a good thing.
I'll say this: you know, it's always interesting when I hear conservatives talk about the government because I am a government worker, and I spend a lot of time trying to figure out what's the most efficient way I can get all these tasks done. I really do care, and I don't think that everybody cares because everyone's human. But
most of the time when I refer to the government, I'm not referring, most workers in the government want to do things well, but you can't change the whole structure of the system. You can't change a number of things because, one, they're legislated, and two, you know, they're managed by people that have different priorities. So you are given a workload and you have to perform that workload well. And, you know, most government workers, I don't think are like, hey, I just want to shag the system. I don't want to, you know, like, most government workers are not like that. They want to do their work. They want to do those things. It's because you have a different paradigm in the private sector that causes a lot of the efficiency driving, and because there's a competition.
Right.
I mean, so if your McDonald's and a Wendy's opens up across the street that offers things cheaper, faster, better,
you gotta bring
people are going to stop going to that McDonald's.
Either you got to bring
your prices down. You got to figure out a way to fix it.
Either you have to bring your prices down, or you have to make your burgers tastier and ideally bring the prices down anyway.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's... But as a postal service or the DMV, there's never going to be another DMV opened up across the street. So you don't ever have to deal with competition, with competitive, like, positive destruction, basically.
I will say this.
Old stuff gets pushed out.
I will say this. A lot of prisons have been privatized, and they are less safe, I have been told, than publicly run jails. the Corrections Corporation of America skimps on a lot of safety stuff. Skimps in general. And so, for example, you can have a situation where there's one or two guards watching 300 prisoners. That's the efficiency of we don't care if our employees get killed.
You know, so, I mean, I can't speak for the prison thing. The prison system may be something that would work better in a government, from a government
perspective. And I do think, I think there are things that do work.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, that may be one of the places where that works better. I haven't studied it, so I don't really know. But there are places where it is better in a private hands. Interestingly, there's a group that runs, they're a contractor for the government that basically they're this guy who runs this group, or he ran the group, looking at it from a analysis standpoint, with a few hundred to a couple thousand guys on the ground, he's like, you know, we could take out ISIS in a couple of months with just a contractor group. But from the military standpoint, it would probably take them tens of thousands of troops on the ground to do the same sort of thing.
Well, with ISIS, the problem is long-term damage to why does anybody want to be anything other than a terrorist?
So I think, what would you say our common ground
our
is?
Our common ground is that
we... You know what my position is.
I would say our common ground is that a more efficient workplace is the optimal workplace. Delivers more benefits for everyone, and that there are some places that really should be privatized, and that there are some places that really should remain publicly run. And which of those is which is up for discussion.
Yeah, I think that that makes sense.
All right. This is Dan Barish, the Jewish liberal from Cleveland, signing off.
And this is Matt Shepard, the Mormon conservative from Seattle, signing off.